So, we have the six winemakers in no particular order, but well, I'll introduce the order they are up here. Michael Martella from Fogarty Estate Vineyards. We have Jeffrey Patterson from Mount Eden. Ed Munns, Munns Vineyard. Steve Storrs. Sal from Vine Hill. And Ryan Beauregard, who I don't see, but, oh, there he is. So what we'll do is have each of our panelists speak for about 10 minutes or 8 minutes to be precise. And they're going to try to answer the question that we posed in terms of what is it about their sub-region that makes them passionate about the wine they produce there, and how is that reflected in the character of the wine. And it will be interesting to see what each has to say. I'm particularly interested in what Steve has to say about Corralitos, since that's where we're located. So. I think we'll try to go roughly from north to south, even though it's not a true north-south orientation. So we'll start with Michael Martella, and then move on down the table. Michael?
Well, good to see you all. I really want to thank the organizers for this event. They really do a lot of work and put this together, and about this time I feel like there's a lot of people, always the same people doing all the work, and then people like me who kind of freeloaders and kind of come in on the coattails of everybody does the work. But I promise next year I'd like to be more involved, so I'm trying to do that. I've been at Thomas Fogarty Winery. I've been making Pinot Noir up there, growing Pinot Noir up there since 1983. We planted our first vineyard. And I also buy some Pinot Noir from the other sub-appellations. I've been buying Pinot Noir from the Summit area, from the Corralitos area, and a little bit out of the Los Gatos area. And I really think this is a great discussion about trying to figure out the differences in all the areas. The areas are different, and Pinot Noir really does express the differences. And Pinot Noir is a very expressive grape, so Pinot Noir also expresses all the other variations that Clark kind of touched upon. And I think one of the most overriding expressions is Cologne. So what I'm trying to say is I've also found, so it makes it kind of confusing to taste these wines and just say that represents this area and that wine represents that area. I have found that, like, my Martini Cologne is more similar to the Martini Cologne grown in Reagan's vineyard than would be my one of my Dijon clones grown on my own property. So that makes it really hard to taste these wines and see the differences. And I do take, I do find that Clark's suggestion of music for our area was really off. I mean, we are like just miles away from La Honda, and there's so much acid.
So Santa Cruz Mountains, someone has described as a marriage of fog and sun, and I think that's probably a really good description of it. And I think throughout the morning you'll be hearing references to the fog and the sun and the interaction of the two and the different subregions in the Santa Cruz Mountains and how those interact. In your handouts, you have some placemats. During the break, which starts at 10:30 and ends at 10:45, we'll pour six wines, one from each of the subregions for each person. So just before you leave for the break, take out your placemats and put them there at your place, and we'll go around and pour the wines and distribute the glasses and so forth. I'll at the end this morning go through some other housekeeping things in terms of where we might go for lunch the rest of the day, et cetera. I think where you can start in the Santa Cruz Mountains at a pretty early point in history. The history of grape growing, as many of you know, in the Santa Cruz Mountains goes back to the 1860s with the Jarvis brothers. They planted vineyards up in the Vine Hill area, and various numbers have been quoted for how many acres they had under cultivation, but apparently they had as many as 2,000 acres up there under cultivation, although I've seen some numbers as low as 200. But anyway, it was significant planting of vineyards, and that really started the Santa Cruz Mountains on its way. And then by the late 1800s, there were roughly about 40 wineries in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So the history, which I don't have time to go into this morning, is really has a lot of wonderful things to talk about. You know, historical figures such as Martin Ray and Paul Masson got their start in the Santa Cruz Mountains. There's a number of other figures that got known later for being in Napa or Sonoma, but who actually started in the Santa Cruz Mountains. In terms of the AVA in the Santa Cruz Mountains, it actually was approved in 1981. And it was the first mountain American viticultural area, or AVA, in the US. And it was the first that was really defined by its geophysical boundaries, by altitude and climatic factors. Prior to this, it was the AVAs, the other AVAs, were really just geographic areas like counties, you know, Sonoma County, as an example, or the Russian River Valley, or something like that. The AVA, which, yes, we'll have a picture of here, is quite large. It starts in the mountains north of Saratoga with the skyline area up here. And it runs all the way down to the Corralitos area in the foothills just above Watsonville. So it's about 60 miles long, a little over 60 miles, I guess. This area has a total of almost 500,000 acres, but only now about 1,500 are planted. And in fact, of course, in the 1800s, there were more total acres than that planted. So prohibition and various other things over the years really cut down on the grape growing, but over the last decade or so, it's had a real resurgence in the Santa Cruz Mountains. I think back to when we started our winery. We planted our vineyards in 1996. We were the only winery in the Corralitos area at that time, and some of the few vineyards. Now, as you can see in Corralitos, which is a little inset here, there are quite a few vineyards, and we have now four wineries with a fifth on the way. So all of this in a little over 10 years. We have in the Santa Cruz Mountains about 75 Pinot Noir vineyards and roughly about 700 acres. So by Sonoma scale, Santa Cruz Mountains is very small, but because of the geographic diversity and the six subregions that we'll talk about today, you just get some incredible variety, incredible Pinot Noirs coming out of the mountains because the terroir, the climate are really kind of perfect for Pinot Noir. So anyway, we have this morning three major segments. The first will be presented by Joe Miller, a well-known professor from UC Santa Cruz, world traveler, real Burgundy file, About 15 years ago, I first met Joe, and I took a class from him on Burgundy. So he knows Burgundy really well, and he's also a winemaker, started to make wine in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So he will kind of compare the two and talk about terroir and how that affects Pinot Noir. Then Clark Smith, our keynote speaker this morning, will talk about the subregions. We'll talk more about some of the work he's done with Appalachian America, and that should be very interesting. After the break, then, at about 10:45, we'll have six winemakers, one from each of the regions, pouring a wine from that region, talking about their region and the wines that it produces. So that's the day. If there are any questions, I'll take them now. If not, I'll turn it over to Joe and start hearing about terroir. Okay. Yes?
So is Coralitas part of the Santa Cruz
Mountains? It is part of the Santa Cruz Mountains ABA. I should have probably mentioned that the ABA has a very irregular boundary, but basically on the western side of the mountains, it starts at about 400 feet. On the eastern side, the warmer side, it starts between 600 and 800 feet, depending upon where you are. So all of the subregions that we'll talk about today are part of the Santa Cruz Mountains ABA. Ben Lomond actually has its own ABA as well. That we think of it as a sixth subregion. So, good question, though. I meant to actually talk about the altitudes. Okay.
Jim, you said approximately 75 vineyards planted to Pinot Noir.
Yes.
Sorry, how many acres?
About almost 700. Yeah.
So roughly half of the total.
Yes, roughly half the total. The rest, you know, on the eastern side, particularly Cabernet, Zinfandel, warmer varietals, Merlot, and then Chardonnay all over. Yes, Chardonnay all over. So, Joe.
Well, thanks, Jim. It's a real pleasure to come here today and speak about Burgundy and its relationship to the Santa Cruz Mountains. I'm a native Californian. I started out drinking California wines, but I also have a deep interest in French wines, and in particular the wines of Burgundy, though I make California wines, and I've been making Pinot Noir for more than 30 years, largely from the Santa Cruz Mountains, but also from other places. And today I'm going to talk as sort of an introduction to the main subject of this morning's discussions, this concept of terroir, which is almost a terrible word to pronounce and get it right, but I'll just keep saying it my way, terroir. And as it says in the title of my talk, in Burgundy at least, terroir is literally protected by law. That's not like most places in France. Even in Bordeaux, it is not protected by law. If you buy a Lafite Rothschild or a Mouton Rothschild or one of the other wines from the area or commune called Pauillac, they all have the same appellation. Their AVA, if you want to call it that, but it isn't an A, is all the same. Lafite, Mouton, Latour are all appellation Pauillac. No finer protection or delimitation of area than that. The grapes just have to be grown in the commune of Pauillac. Lafite, Latour have no vineyard protection that is narrower than Pauillac. However, when you go to Burgundy, Burgundy is subdivided into regions where, in fact, the terroir changes by appellation and literally by the foot. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, and then at the end try to bring this back to the Santa Cruz Mountains. And does this change the slides? Okay, I'll push a button and see what happens. This map, of course, is too detailed to read, but is to give you an overview. This is where Pinot Noir comes from in France at its height. In fact, almost in its entirety. French Burgundy, of course, is a very famous wine throughout the world, and it's hard for many people who are not familiar with it to realize how small a region Burgundy is. In fact, the wines that give Burgundy, or Pinot Noir, its fame come from vineyards that are less than 700 acres. This amount of acreage that Jim just mentioned for the Santa Cruz Mountains that may correspond to a potentially Pinot Noir in the Santa Cruz Mountains, that is more than all of the acreage of what I would call first-class Pinot Noir in France. And once you leave Burgundy, the only other major place you're going to find Pinot Noir in France is Champagne, where it is the dominant grape, of course, of Champagne. If you go elsewhere in France, you do not find Pinot Noir except in some random places where it does not make a notable wine. If you go elsewhere in Europe, you'll find plantings in Germany, Italy, and Switzerland, and again, it does not make a notable wine. In fact, it makes a drinkable wine, is the way I would put it. So, in these two strips, which are actually a photograph I took of maps hanging on the wall in my dining room, so I can leap up at any moment to double-check the location of a vineyard, if we're having two different wines, where they sit relative to one another, you see two parts of Burgundy. Each map there is about 15 miles long, so we're seeing 30 miles. The Côte de Nuit, the upper one, is the northern part. The Côte de Beaune is the southern part. And from your distance, you'll notice that there are colors on there, I hope, and it is the darker purple. And there may even be a laser in this thing, is there? Oh, okay. And I didn't bring mine. But you'll see there's sort of darker purple colors. Okay. Darker purple in here, and one vineyard here. There's one vineyard here, and a sprinkling of vineyards, and you'll see they run along a pattern here, a ridge line. Those vineyards are rated Grand Cru, the great growths of Pinot Noir in Burgundy, where Pinot Noir reaches its height, and we're talking there only about a few hundred acres. And that is what really gives Burgundy its fame. So, if we zoom in a little closer, you see in the Côte de Beaune, there's a number of, and I don't know if that can be focused a little bit sharper or not. Okay, I can't tell from where I am. But the major city is Beaune, oops, we went through it. There we go, is Beaune. This Côte de Beaune is as much Chardonnay territory as Pinot territory. Famous Pinot district here is Pommard, but down further south, Poligny-Montrachet, Chassagne-Montrachet, white wine territory largely, but there's still Pinot grown in these areas too. And you'll see these little dashed lines, dotted lines, those separate the communes. And as you go from commune to commune, the terroir changes, the wine changes. It's distinctive. So, for example, the red wine of Volnay is distinctly different from the red wine of Pommard. The distance here, you see down here, that is, what, 1 kilometer? Can't quite see from where I am. Think so. So, in going 1 kilometer from Volnay to Pommard, the wine changes from a rather delicate, typically a delicate, sort of perfumey, elegant wine to a much more muscular style in Pommard. It's quite distinctive. If you had two examples that exemplified the two communes, you'd instantly notice they are very different. Pommard is a wine that when I was in shape, which means that I could afford to drink these wines all the time and recognize them, I could instantly pick out a Volnay in a blind tasting because it is so distinctive. And I'll just say as an aside, there's no California Pinot I've ever tasted that tastes like a Volnay. It's rather unique. I've tasted California wines, though, that do taste somewhat like a Pommard, a more muscular style. And so on, all the way up. The northern section is where the Pinot Noir comes into its real heights. If we go from north to south, Gevrey-Chambertin, very famous for its great Chambertin vineyard, and next to it, Chambertin-Clos de Vez, Maurice Saint-Denis, Chambon-Musigny. These towns all are named, as most of you probably know, because, in a funny way, they changed their name. The town Gevrey Chambertin used to be Gevrey. But then the great vineyard there is Chambertin. And they said, well, wait a minute. We'd like to call all the wines between these dotted lines. We'd like to attach that magic name to all of them, so we'll change the name of the town to Gevrey Chambertin. It's like if, as an example, if Corralitos decided that, I'll just pick a name, that Windy Oaks was the, such a great vineyard, they changed the name of Corralitos to Corralitos-Windy Oaks, so that every wine that came from anywhere in there could be called Corralitos-Windy Oaks. I just made that up, yeah.
What is the majority of the difference in terroir in these sections so close that affect the wine?
I'm going to come to that. Because, as you might guess, if, and I'll say it right now ahead of time, if going from Gevrey Chambertin, from that dash line to that dash line is 3 miles, and then you go into Marie Saint-Denis and you walk 100 feet and you're into Marie Saint-Denis, clearly the weather isn't going to have changed significantly. But it doesn't take an experienced taster to realize the wine has suddenly changed, and even more dramatically changes when you go from Marie Saint-Denis into Chambeau-Musigny. If you walked 100 feet, and you can walk easily in a day almost through this whole region, and the wines change every 100 feet or 200 feet, clearly it's not the weather. So let's go on here. The heart of the whole region, in some people's mind, the great vineyard, greatest vineyard of all in this region, is Romani Conti. I took this slide almost 40 years ago, no, more than 40 years ago, so it sort of faded. And it's only 4.5 acres. And here's where an illustration of the difference between Burgundy and Bordeaux is. This vineyard has its own appellation contrôlée. It is its own viticultural area. It needs to put nothing more on the label than Romani Conti, appellation contrôlée. 4.5 acres. That's all it has to say. It doesn't have to say any more thing, anything else than that. By law, it has to be 100% Pinot Noir. There has to be a certain amount of production per acre. It's limited to around 2 tons, or a little less as a Grand Cru, something like that, a little over roughly 2 tons. And it can't be irrigated. In fact, no appellation contrôlée vineyard in France can be irrigated. If you're appellation contrôlée, you cannot be irrigated. And if you look at the next slide, I always find it sort of appalling to think that here is this great vineyard, and it looks pretty crummy in this slide. But it, like a book, I guess you can't judge a wine by its vineyard. But this comes on the market now for something like, $1,000 a bottle, if you can find it. And they'll probably limit you to 2 bottles or something like that. It's owned by the Domaine de la Romani Conti, as they own all of it, as do they own right across the street, La Tâche. It says a monopole, and this too is in some years tastes better to me that I, when I've had it, than Romani Conti, another fine wine. And this has just become available for you, those of you who want to buy it, at Premier Cru in Oakland. Here's their description they've had for the from the Burghound. That first sentence is the longest run-on sentence I think I've ever read. Here, too, is a very reserved yet ultra-classy and refined, indeed even ethereal nose that is quite simply kaleidoscopic in its breadth, combining red, blue, and black fruits with spice, earth, minerality, and a hint of underbrush that stands aside for the perfectly balanced, pure, and stylish medium-full flavors that are very firmly but not aggressively structured while delivering flat-out, unbelievable length, yet all the while remaining completely understated in personality. Now that is... Yes.
Amused by its presumption.
But I like the next sentence. There's a term there that you rarely see for a wine. As are all the best vintages of RC, Romani Conti, this is spherical, with nothing out of place, and this will age effortlessly for decades. The La Tâche is truly spectacular, but there is simply another dimension of depth presented here. A wine of sheer class and the epitome of the phrase power without weight. Okay, well, I think that must be a pretty good wine, but for $1,000. And furthermore, this is an 06, and in my experience, the great Burgundies I've had have always had a minimum of 10 years on them. I've never had a great Burgundy that I would say has really reached what it could be when it's 4 years old or 5 years old, which is something I'll come back to when we talk about California wines. Okay, so if we zoom in a little more on the Côte de Nuits, this is just to illustrate from the standpoint of where we're going next. There is a real geographical distribution of the Grand Cru vineyards. The purple again, you see it runs along a narrow line here. And when I say Grand Cru, these are legally protected. They were classified in 1930 or so. These patches of land have for hundreds and hundreds of years produced the greatest wines. They are protected by law as being able to use Grand Cru, and they all have their own Appellation Contrôlées. They are individually protected. Then you see a lighter color, sort of a rose color, salmon color. Those are the Premier Cru. Those are protected as being the first growths, as they're called, and they are lesser in quality, and those vineyards have been graded that way at about the same time as the Grand Crus. And then the lighter colored ones, light pink, those are just called village wines. And you see the village wines are further away from the Grand Crus. Generally, the Premier Crus cluster around the Grand Crus, and then as you get further away from the Grand Crus, you see first the Premiers, then you see the village wines. This classification, it was not a result of payoffs to the right people. If you, in fact, when I was here a few years ago, when I did a tasting, we went a village wine of Chambol, a village wine of Gevrey, to show the difference in the terroir, and then we went from the village wine of Gevrey to a Grand Cru of Gevrey, just to show the difference in the classification, and that when you go to Grand Cru, you really do make a step up, both in quality and in price. That doesn't mean a Premier can't be as good as a Grand Cru in certain years or with the hands of a different maker, because they can rise to heights, but on average, year in and year out, the Grand Crus will be better, and a Premier Cru generally will, at its best, can never be as, or rarely will be as good as a Grand Cru at its very best. The best are always usually found there, but there are, of course, exceptions to this. So there you see, there is clearly something going on in the soil along this ridge line, which extends all the way down this way and outlines where the Grand Crus are, and it stops about here. This is in Vaux Romanée, and right where my red pointer is Romani Conti. Latoche is right across there, and then it ends. And that's it. There's no more Grand Crus down here until you cross over, and briefly, very briefly, there's a little bit of the right soil again in Corton, and you again have a Grand Cru in Le Corton. And on that same hill, as you go around to the west, the Chardonnay gets a Grand Cru status as Corton Charlemagne. And then there's only a few more vineyards that are Grand Cru Pinot, just one little area right around Le Montrachet. And that's, so there's only really four vineyards, though some are subdivided with different names. They get Grand Cru status for Chardonnay, and there's something like 28 or so that are Grand Cru for Pinot. And that's really what all the fuss is about with Burgundy. Okay, so as we go from these communes, Gevrey, Chambol, etc., the flavors change, and I'll talk more about that.
Can I ask it?
Yeah. Yeah, this great big one is the biggest of the Grand Cru vineyards, Clos Vougeot. And really, the wine from closest to N74, the road here, is actually not really of Grand Cru status, a lot of people agree. And the wine up near the wall is the best. And that leads to another thing I'll mention as an aside. When the French Revolution occurred, it was power to the people, and they decided these vineyards shouldn't be owned by a single person anymore. They should be subdivided. And so most of these vineyards are owned by many people. And some people only own a row or half a row. So it makes it very complicated if there's 10 owners or 15 owners and they each make different wine. Keeping track in any given year of what Burgundy is which. Some sell their grapes, some make the wine and then sell the wine and barrel to somebody, and so on. The monopole, the single owner vineyard, is the exception, the rarity rather than the rule. So in the case of Clos Vougeot, I don't know how many owners there are, but there are dozens and dozens of this big vineyard. And the quality of that wine goes all the way, what I would call, from village wine up to Grand Cru status. They all charge a high price, though, because they've got that magic Clos Vougeot Grand Cru status. Yeah.
You said this was established in 1930, the various...
Right.
Is there any movement in that? Is there any chance of a premier moving up to a Grand Cru or Grand Cru?
Yeah, there have been applications for that. There's one that's sort of... I'll show you, let's see if it's on this map. I can't quite read it, but it's on this map. It's in Maurice Saint-Denis here, Clos de Lambret, which is a premier, which calls itself a grand, and apparently they've been arguing about that for about 25 or 30 years. And they put on their label Grand Cru, but and nobody's ever arrested anybody for it, but it's not clear whether it is or not. There's another vineyard that I think should be a Grand Cru that is in Chambeau-Musigny, and it's right here is Le Musigny, this purple here, right on the edge, and just below it here is Les Amoureux. And most people think that that should be moved up to a Grand Cru. And in fact, when I visited the Comte du Vauguay, who makes, I think, one of the finest Musignys, they also make Amoureux, and they're firmly of the view, probably because they could charge more for it even, but that their Amoureux is as a fine a wine as their Musigny. Oops, I've been going backwards. Let me go forward. What's that?
Let's read that again.
Yeah, right. And as I said, in the Côte de Beaune, this is the only Grand Cru. This is Courton. And this yellow here is Courton Charlemagne, the Chardonnay that's on this pot. This is the biggest city in the area, Beaune. And there's, I'll just mention, because I'm going to come back to it, up here is Beaune-Brisson, Beaune-Grève, two vineyards. I'm pointing those out. Across the freeway here, this is the main freeway A6 that comes from Paris going to the Riviera. Savigny-Libon, I'm mentioning that because I'm going to come back to it. Okay, I'm going to just now hone in on a section and finish, talk about the terroir in more detail, just picking out this. Fissin is to the north of Gevrey-Chambertin. There are some premier crus, but no grand crus. They really start here, and you see there's a whole string of them in Gevrey-Chambertin with Clos de Bez here, Chambertin there. This is a real slew of them here. And then this dashed line here is the boundary, and you go into Maurice Saint-Denis. These are big, strong, full-bodied wines. They're often the easiest for a person that's beginning to learn how to identify French Burgundies by taste alone, blind, to identify. On the other extreme here, down in Chambeau, these are among the most delicate of the Burgundies. They're often, in the olden days when such terms were used, they were called feminine wines. I would describe them as more wines of great finesse, delicacy, with Musigny here at the end, showing great refinement, great delicacy, strength, but in a sense of not being powerful, rich, strong wines, but strength in terms of intensity of refined flavors. And in between, Maurice Saint-Denis is sort of the average of these two. It's not as powerful and strong as Gevrey, and it is not as delicate and refined as Chambeau. It's a little bit coarser, and it fits right in between, and we're talking about a distance here to here of roughly less than a mile. If you look carefully, there's a vineyard here that you have to look very carefully that's called Bonmar. That's mainly in Chambeau-Musigny, but it extends right across the dotted line, and there's a small strip that's in Maurice Saint-Denis. It's the same vineyard. In fact, if you make the wine separately from Bonmar, that's just over that little dotted line, it tastes different from the stuff that's on the other side of that strip. It tastes like a Maurice Saint-Denis. It doesn't taste like a Chambeau-Musigny. It has more of that strength to it, more of that muscle to it, than does the Bonmar that's made on the Chambeau-Musigny side. So there are clear differences as you go from commune to commune to commune, and it holds up year after year after year with one proviso, which I'll come back to again. The winemaker doesn't screw it up. I mean, it's very easy for a winemaker to hide the origin, the terroir, by what they do when they make the wine. There are only a few products that are grown in the soil, a few crops that retain where they were grown. One are grapes, another is coffee. I happen to roast my own coffee, and I know you can tell once you get used to roasting coffee from different places where it came from very easily. Sumatra, Java, they all have different flavors, but if you over roast it, make it too dark, you lose it. You lose where it came from. And another strange thing that retains its origin very well is cigar tobacco leaf. That you can really tell the difference between Honduras and especially Cuba when you can get, well, I won't go into that. and Dominican Republic. But I think when it comes to the winner in all of this are grapes. As long as you don't blow it, I shouldn't use that term, that's pejorative. As long as you don't hide the source of origin, and I'll mention that when I come back to Santa Cruz near the inn. So, some winemakers from this region actually preserve the terroir very well, others tend to hide it a bit. It's quite distinctive. And then as you go further south, the same thing happens again. In the case of Vougeot, this area here, I find that more indistinct. I don't have a particular characteristic I associate with it. But then when you get to Vaughan-Romanée, then that commune has a very distinctive characteristic, which I would describe more as a sort of opulence, a richness, a complexity of style that is not seen to the north at all of this, and not seen to the south. It's unique, and it's a flavor in Pinot grown there that I don't see anywhere outside of Vaughan-Romanée. I don't see it anywhere in Oregon. I don't see it in California yet. I've never seen it. To the north, I've seen those flavors in California wines, in Oregon wines, but I've never seen Vaughan, the flavors from this area. I've never seen that spherical character yet.
I was
going to say. Yeah, right. But those are unique and can be quite amazing wines in that small area. Well, I was asked about what's going on here, and there's quite a bit of literature on the subject, and it's very complicated, as you might guess. These are cross-sections through the land at four slices of Burgundy, Gevrey-Chambertin at Vougeot, Alas-Corton, Merceau, and it shows different kinds of soil by different colors, with the marks being where the vineyards start and where they stop. And you can see it's a very complicated undersoil, and from at Gevrey-Chambertin looks quite a bit different from Vougeot, and down at Corton again it looks quite different. I don't have the time to go into this, nor am I an expert on all of this, but it is a fascinating subject. But the bottom line is, when you go from Gevrey-Chambertin and walk 50 feet into Maurice Saint-Denis, the soil just changes, and that changes things. There was debates as to whether, since they always replant with grass from their same vineyard, or they're just clonal differences as you go on. But these differences have been known for hundreds and hundreds of years, and there must have been a genetic drift in those vines. I can't believe that they preserve genetic differences by commune to commune to commune that are so striking. The soil is known to be different, and as you go from commune to commune, and I'm convinced that it's a reflection of the soil, the drainage, exposure, tilt of the landscape, and all that. There just is a change as you go from place to place, and it's reflected in the wine. What are the elevations?
Yeah.
Typically, there's a rise of somewhere between 200 and 300 feet, 400 feet, from the low points to the high points at most, something like that. It's not real steep like down in the Rhone Valley. Let's just take a few minutes to look at some of these vineyards, and then things don't change rapidly except for the person. That was my first trip there in 1972 at the interest of Gevrey-Chambertin, and then about 30 years later, that's the same sign. It looks exactly the same, with the sign underneath it the same. Standing at an intersection that's on the route of the Grand Cru, where you can drive through the mall. That hotel on the left where I stayed didn't exist 30 years before. But this is just outside the hotel, a shot of a dormant vineyard, and you notice how stubby all the vines are. The pruning is very different there. They prune them very tightly, very compactly. I have some more pictures that show that. Here's a close-up. The vines look quite old, very, very tightly pruned, very close spacing.
Do you know what month this was in?
What's that?
What month these pictures were taken?
I should also warn you, you're going to get time dizziness here, because these are about five or six different trips. This was taken, I believe, in something like April. Yeah, about April. That one was taken probably earlier than that. No, that's April also. I can see them coming out. As was this. This is the Clos de Bez vineyard. As you walk out of the town of Gevrey-Chambertin, you walk about just 5 minutes and you come to this. You see it's sort of flat in the foreground, and then it goes up the hill, further up, and then just ends at the forest. And there's no grapes up there. There's no point in clearing that forest. That's where that pin was in the map. The soil changes. Everything's different. Right next to it, they let you know. This is the beginning of Chambertin. It's nicely tended. Lots of rocks mixed in with the soil, limestone pieces, I think those are. This is Pierre de Moy section right in here. If you just turn around, I'm standing on the road when I took this picture, and look the other direction. That is Charme Chambertin, another great growth, Grand Cru. And then you see in the distance those trucks. That's N74, the main road locally. And on the other side, just a little bit beyond, are cows grazing. So you go from great growth to no vineyards in a few hundred yards. And they don't grow anymore. Grapes, it doesn't pay. It doesn't. You would think in California they would probably just keep extending it out. If this vineyard is producing $100 a bottle of wines, certainly on the other side of that road you could make wine that would sell for 30 or 40 or something, because you're right next to it. They stop. There's no point in it. It's all over. The strip is only a half a mile wide, and they stop. So Burgundy is very narrow, and it has taken hundreds, literally 1,000 years of refinement. The Clos de Tarr vineyard, which is about half a mile from here, is known in documents to go back to the 11th century as an identified vineyard.
What's that row spacing?
What's that?
What's the row spacing?
The row spacing there typically is about a meter, something like a meter. And the vine spacing is about that. And just to show you that not all of the greatest vineyards look sort of crummy, this is the greatest Chardonnay vineyard in the world. It is claimed by many. This is Le Morachet, and this is probably the best tended vineyard I have ever seen. It looked like there were women in there that gave me the evil eye when I stopped to look at them. They didn't like me even stopping to look at them. That had what looked like manicure scissors that were going through trimming the leaves. But there, if you walk down the rows, you would be brushing on both sides. But there again, this comes out in the market at $600 to $1,000 a bottle. And this was immaculate. There wasn't even a twig or a leaf on the ground. And I think they went through and picked up, even a leaf, if it fell on the ground, was picked up here. This was an unbelievably well-kept vineyard. Yes? You know, I don't know. I believe there is an answer to that question, but I don't know the answer to that. I believe it is probably related to the uptake during the course of the year. What happens during the complex interplay of during photosynthesis and what's drawn up into the plant from the soil? But you know, if after 1,000 years, it's amazing that these plots of land are still doing so well. You know, they put back in the press cakes, they distribute that back into the vineyards, they do mulching. There's a lot of biodynamic going on in some places. It's not clear to me that that makes any greater wine. I think the main thing it does is that people pay a lot more attention to their vineyards when they're doing biodynamic farming. It's one of the most important things that happens when they do that. And I don't, being an astronomer, I don't put a lot of stock in the phase of the moon or where Jupiter is relative to Virgo when you're picking your grapes, but that's just an aside. So, this then is a remarkable thing, I think, in wine, that going from Chèvre Chambertin, Maurice Saint-Denis, Chambeau-Musigny, in the course of 3 or 4 miles, by region, the wines change. Not by vineyard, by region, and it's persistent for a long time. So, to conclude, what about Santa Cruz Mountain terroir? Well, first I'd say we've only just begun, and we're going to hear about this beginning today. I look forward to that. Is it patchy or regional? Do we have this same regional thing here? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Is Corralitos to the summit one region? Is Bonnie Dune up there another region? And they're very different? I have a feeling as I walk around, the soil can change very quickly and the drainage can change very quickly, but I could be wrong. But we're going to hear about that, so I'm looking forward to learning about that. I can give you one very, very extremely limited non-scientific result, because one winemaker, me, I've made wine from 4 different vineyards, Pinot Noir, widely scattered. So I remove the winemaker variable. And similarly, I'll come to I don't use much oak, because as I'll come to, oak can really hide terroir very easily. And so I've made from 4 vineyards in the Santa Cruz Mountains Pinot Noir, sometimes repeatedly. The Cox Vineyard, which no longer exists as a Pinot Vineyard, it was killed by Pierce's disease and replanted with Merlot. And I made Pinot from that in its last year, which was 88. And that wine reminded me a lot of a Corton. In fact, just to summarize this, it is only the wines of the Santa Cruz Mountains that to me bring similarities or reminders of wines of Burgundy. I don't get that so much in the Russian River Valley. I don't get that at all in the Santa Rita Hills. And I don't get that at all from the Santa Lucia Highlands. Whether that's bad or good is a different issue. I'm just saying, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, I get more French style in the wines than I do in these other areas, on average, not always, but on average. I just spent a couple of days in the Russian River Valley and tasted about 40 Pinots. They're very different from the Santa Cruz Mountains. They're nice, they're different though. Okay, so Cox, so when I make these wines, I keep thinking of what they remind me of, and the Cox Vineyard reminded me of Corton, and a blind tasting of French Burgundies, when this wine was about 14 years old, it was put in as a ringer, the one California wine. These are all French wine drinkers. Nobody took it for a California wine. 3 people picked it as their favorite and said they thought it was a Corton. So in a blind tasting, that's what people thought it was. Leboeuf, Bernie Leboeuf's vineyard is right next to the campus on Empire Grade, and it is very Chambeau-Musigny-like, very much that way. It's very delicate. Often the color is a little on the light side, extremely different from the Cox Vineyard. Then this year, our first crush is a bonded winery. I made great wine from Fambrini's vineyard, which is right next to Highway 1. This is really right next to the coast, thanks to Prudy Fox. And he had 2 clones. I kept the clones separate. One of the clones was much I like better than the other one. And this, to me, is Maurice Saint-Denis. It's not Chambertin. It's not Chèvre Chambertin with its muscularity. It's not Chambeau-Musigny. It's an average of the two. But this is at 5 months. You know, that wine does handsprings and changes its character every few weeks. So it's premature. And then I made a Pinot from the Regan Vineyard in Corralitos. And that is Bone. Very much like Bone Brisson that I pointed out, or Bone Greve. Though it could be Sauvigny Le Bone. It's too early to say. But it's definitely Bone. It is not Côte de Nuit. It is Côte de Bone. And it's very nice. Outside of the Santa Cruz Mountains, I made wine from Pinot from Carneros, and it tastes like Carneros. What can I say? It's nice, but it tastes like Carneros. There's no French wine that I would say is like that. It's nice, and I made it from Arroyo Seco, and that tastes like California Pinot. And I've made three different clones for a vineyard there that wanted me to test three different clones so they know which to rip out. And I said if they had a pick, they should pick one of the three clones, which they did. And then they finally gave up on Pinot at that vineyard. So, finally, do we want Santa Cruz Mountain Pinot Noir to taste like French Burgundy? Or even be referenced to French Burgundy like I've been doing? That's an open question. Frankly, I wouldn't mind somebody writing up my wine the way that Romani Conti was written up, even though it's a bit excessive, but still, I think I have had California, I have had wines from the Santa Cruz Mountains that I think are certainly a premier cru status compared to French Burgundies. Maybe I've had some that are better than some Grand Crus, where the Grand Crus weren't of the highest status. I think the potential in the Santa Cruz Mountains is enormous, but we've just begun. I mean, if you think it took 1,000 years to get to this classification, and we have such little plantings here. The most important thing, though, as I said before, is you can ruin the terroir, you can ruin the source of origin by the winemaking. And I think too much oak, too high in alcohol. All the great French Burgundies I've had have all been under 14% alcohol. Most have probably been between 12.5% and 13.5%, every one of them. And the greatest ones, I think I could never say very nice refined oak. Couldn't detect oak. There's a trend more in Burgundy these days to use more oak because the customers want it, I think. But so these are, if you want to preserve the terroir, I think careful, very, very careful use of oak and alcohol will bring out the fruit that the growers so desperately try to maximize in potential. So thank you.
Joe, thank you very much. I'm always amazed at your encyclopedic knowledge of Burgundy in particular, and you'll notice he had no notes or anything, and it's all up here.
And I'm sorry I went on a little too long. That
we're doing fine. Yes? Thank you. We'll move on to our next speaker. In some ways, I suppose, has stirred up a bit of controversy over the past few years. Clark Smith is the one of the founders of Vinnovation, which has been a somewhat controversial company on its own, I believe. But he's here today in his capacity as the taste master, for lack of a better term that comes to mind, at Appalachian America. And he's done some pioneering work, I think, in looking at and defining subregions and identifying characteristics that really can be applied to those subregions in general. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Clark.
Well, I want to begin by thanking you all for redeeming the reputation of California Pinot Noir. I think everything that was said previously is really true. And Chardonnay too, thank you very much. You guys are sort of the ABC Chardonnay crowd, you know, because you don't make oaky, toasty butter bombs. You make wines with quite a bit of distinction and restraint. You make us look good. There is a problem with what you're doing, and I'll tell you in a second.
I knew I couldn't get out slash tree.
Yeah. It's my problem. It's not really your problem, but we'll get into it in a second. I want to explain a little about Appalachian America. We really want to be your marketing partner. And it's because, you know, what I really am now... I ran Vinovation for 15 years, the largest wine production consulting firm in the world, and we introduced a lot of innovations, some of which people think are really evil. But we did sort of create a cooking school for winemakers, and I got finished with that. And now I think the primary challenge in the wine industry is not production. It's that we have 100 times as many wines as we had when I was selling at Jackson's in the 70s. You know, there were only 80 wineries in California, and there are hardly any outside of the state. So you're talking about, Jackson's was the Library of Congress for wine. We had about 2,000 facings, and half of them were California. And we had every wine in the state. All you had to do was start a winery, send us a postcard and say, I'm up here in Weed and I've got a Gewurztraminer and a Zinfandel, and we'd order a case of each and see how it went. Anybody care to guess how many labels were approved by TTB last year? 140,000. So we have over 100 times as many wines in North America as we had when, 25 years ago. And the problem with most wine review is that we're still tasting as if there were only 50 Pinot Noirs in North America. There's more like 5,000 now. So we've got to get away from the thinking, sort of the Super Bowl mentality, that we're just going to pick out the over 90 scores, the top wines from everywhere as if they all tasted the same, and then everybody else is a loser. So Roger Dial convinced me to quit my job and sell my company and devote myself to being basically the Charles Kuralt of American AVAs. And my little virtual Winnebago, I'm going around and trying to tell the story of each appellation. Here's the article on Iowa. You think you've got promotional problems. Those are good wines, some of them. They don't hit quite as high a percentage as you do, but that's a very interesting place, and it's getting no play whatsoever. So anyway, that's what the site is about. I want to just kind of show you how to use it for your part. To begin with, we have, to the best of our ability, we have a homepage for every winery and a listing of every wine produced in North America on the site. We have all the AVAs have their own pages, so let's just go right. This little search term box is really where the action is. So if I just put in Santa Cruz here. Okay, so that returns. Okay, so down here we've got Santa Cruz County, Santa Cruz Mountains, and the Santa Cruz Mountain Vineyards. So we'll just select this AVA. And here we have a whole pile of stories about Santa Cruz. And then listings of the grapes that are grown here, the wines that are produced, the wineries that are here, wineries that source fruit, and the overlapping appellations like Ben Lomond. And then here's the article that I wrote that led to the subregional discussion, and down in it somewhere is an embedded map that Mary Lindsay tirelessly worked with me to create. And all of the wines that we tasted, we've mapped the vineyards here. I'm going to refer to this map repeatedly. And if your vineyard is on here, please note that we need your soil information. So you might want to look in there and see what we're saying about you and tell us whether it's true. And but if you look, where is it? Right there, this map has received 35,902 views since we posted the article in late November. So you're getting a lot of play out of this. We just put in the technology to to load the BOAs, the best of Appellation status wines, into these call-outs so that you can, the consumer can look at your vineyard. By the way, they can, I guess, for those of old fogies that don't know how Google Maps work, we can just take, let's take Mary's Vineyard here. And we'll just look right up her. Oops, okay. All right. Sorry about that. And then if we do the satellite view, we can actually look at her row inclinations. And it's like the old toast, here's looking up your old address. This has gotten a lot of excitement. So anyway, whenever there's a winery that buys from this, there'll be a link to their winery page. And if there are wines that get BOA status, you'll be able to look at them. Click right to them. And if you should be wise enough to become one of our direct marketing partners, which is how I get paid, for $200 a year, you can populate the site you have, and the links here will take them right to your shopping cart. So that's the commercial announcement. Okay, so I want to come back to the whole region, and I just come back and refer to this as we go along to talk about the regionality. I guess I'll do one other thing. So I can get to this little problem that I have, which is as a wine writer with trying to maintain some kind of credibility, it is discouraging to me to have to award 50 basically Grand Cru and Premier Grand Cru status awards to a small region like yours. It's kind of embarrassing. So I wish at least some of you would start making some crappy wines to make me look good. We rejected very little in this tasting. And I think the reason is that nobody comes to the Santa Cruz Mountains to make wine in order to make money. They show up there because they're trying to get rid of money. I think it's mostly seems to work pretty good. But anyway, it's really created an extraordinary situation, we call them golds and double golds, but what they really are is awards not for general quality, because we don't even believe in general quality, but the golds are like Premier Cru, they're wines which exemplify the terroir. The double golds, Premier Grand Crus are for wines that you would use to convince somebody that had never had a Santa Cruz Mountain wine that they ought to be charmed by the area. So that's really what it's about. Okay. So now I can get off the computer a little bit here. And I'm going to defend the notion that terroir really is king here for a number of reasons, not all of them natural. A lot of it, as in Burgundy, has to do with who you are and the choices that you've made as a group about what you think is the right way to grow wine. Okay, so here's how our process works. Many of you spent a lot of time filling out our exhaustive 60-point product information forms, and we're putting that information on the map. We don't do blind tastings. We don't know who the wineries are, but we know everything else when we're tasting. We know that the soil type, the altitude, I don't want to go through the whole thing, but terroir variables, viticultural variables, clones, winemaking techniques. That's all in front of the panel when we're tasting, so that we can connect the dots, connect what's in the glass to the why of it. And I've never done this before. The other thing we do is to group everything by region, and it's kind of mind-boggling how much regional variability you can focus in on when you put the wines in groups, rather than the traditional judging where they're, you know, all the Pinots in California are just all jumbled up and you can't see the patterns in that case. So anyway, we have a lot of information, including the mapping I've shown you. We don't use critics for tasting. All of our panelists are experienced winemakers. Dick Peterson, Michael Havens, Rick Jones are all part of our panel. And we do this informed, double-blind evaluation. We kind of taste twice. The first time through, we're looking at the groupings and we're trying to have the wines tell us what the regional characteristics are. And so the first thing we do is fill out what we call the Blue Book. And if you go into the varietal characters section of the site and click on the Pinot Noir icon, you'll see there's a Blue Book entry for the four different styles of Pinot Noir that are produced in Santa Cruz Mountains. And then we use that from then on to judge the wines. And that includes wines that come along subsequently. We may find a new style, we may refine the Blue Book based on what the wines are doing. It's a moving target, but at that point we're selecting our best of appellations based on the definitions that we've derived from the group. And as I said, typical examples and compelling examples, gold and double gold. The other thing we do, and I think this is really important going into the future, we want 5 years from now for you to be able to walk into a wine shop or look at a restaurant wine list and to be able to download your preferences, to have your own personal sommelier on here, just like iTunes Genius is doing with music, or Pandora.com. To be able to say, this is my kind of Pinot Noir, what do you got in this shop that's that type? And in order to do that, we have to define consumer groups. And sometimes those line up with specific regions and sometimes they don't. In Santa Cruz, I would say that year to year, because much of the area is somewhat dependent on weather, particularly at high altitudes, that we see the same winery, the same vineyard, one year making one consumer style and another year a different one, just because that's what God hands you. In most other areas in California, it's a winemaking choice. Here, it's more like a climate, seasonal, natural choice that gets made for you. So these are the ones that we came up with. And you'll see there are four different reasons to buy and drink Pinot Noir involved here. The first one we call impact wines. The purpose of these wines is just to blow your ears off. Secondly, what we call solid wines, which have, you know, spherical wines, I guess. Wines with good structural integrity that are knit together and suitable for aging. This may include the notion that they don't taste at their best when they're young, just like great Burgundies. And I agree with you. Certainly 5 years and normally 10 to really see what a wine like this will give you. And so that requires a little bit of sophistication on the part of the consumer. We came up with this term ethereal, which I noticed showed up in one of your descriptions. And these are wines that don't necessarily have much structure at all, but they have such seductive perfume that they sort of carry you away, very sexy wines. And the fourth was a little bit of a grab bag that we called distinctive. And these were wines that are so assertive in their characteristics that the main reason you drink them is basically what I do is to use wine as a cheap form of travel. that you want to taste something that you've never tasted before. Most of the products that we taste, even great beverages like single malt scotches, we're looking for consistency. We want to see, you want to taste the 25-year-old Macallan, and you 20 years later you want to be talking about it like it's all just out of one big vat. And they work very hard to achieve product consistency. That's what we want in our milk, in our cigarettes, most of our beverages, most of our foods. We want the same thing every time. But there's a few things that we buy where that's the last thing we want. Newspapers. We don't want the same newspaper we had yesterday. Movies, books. We want to read something different. These wines are for consumers that look at wine like it was a book or a movie. This is what I just said, that it's somewhat unexpectedly that the climatic variation drives the style more than the winemaking choices. That's my personal conclusion from looking at these wines. So where does all this diversity come from? In the terroir, I'm just going to pick out the things that we thought were the most important from the product information forms and the wines that we looked at. Soil's water holding capacity was very important. Capability for a soil to offer a buffer so that the dry years are wetter and the wet years are drier. And that, of course, derives from soil texture and composition. Growing season temperature profile, which includes diurnal fluctuations, how cold does it get at night, how warm does it get during the day, and what time during the day does it warm up, but also the degree days throughout the season and when they occur, the length of the season, temperature, seem to be very important in the differences that we saw regionally throughout the region. Seasonal rainfall, particularly at high elevation, the dry years make very different wines than the wet years. Incident light played a big role, and of course the most important thing that cuts down on incident light in this area is fog. Wind influence also very important to the viticultural choices that get made. And the other thing, and I'm just amazed that I don't see discussions of this in the literature, in this area, because the vineyards are so small, the native vegetation around the vineyard, I am convinced, is part of the terroir expression. If you think about up on the in the summit area, for example, we have a kind of a droughty condition, and so we've got a lot of bay laurel up there. We've got sage, and those are all of these plants have a wax cuticle just like a grape, and they have aromatics that are in the air. If you walk around in the vineyards in the summer, you can smell them, and they show up in the wine. It's not a big surprise. The most the easiest example is the spot is eucalyptus, but I think there are many other characteristics like that that show up, and they don't show up in Napa because there's nothing there but grapes. Viticultural sources, vine spacing and orientation. Of course, the difference that we have from Burgundy to here is quite striking. I'd love to get in a fist fight with somebody about the minerality issue. I have a lot of fixed views on that. And I think there are actually two sources of minerality. It's quite clear to me from tasting wines from all over that soil does have an impact. We don't have very much limestone in California, but when you see limestone, you see minerality without exception, even when they're using herbicides and pesticides. But what we do have here is a lot of decomposed granite, and that also, I'm quite convinced, imparts minerality. I don't know what the mechanism is, and I don't even know what minerality is. I know that you can reproduce it by putting a mineral tincture, such as is used for soil amendments. Tiny little drop in a glass of wine that's very flat can bring out this mineral aspect, but we've tried to find it with atomic absorption studies on wines that are very minerally versus wines that aren't very minerally, and we can't see a pattern. So I don't know what it is, but it sure exists. And the other thing, the other place where we get it is in living soils. I think the biodynamic approach or organic approach, and I don't care about the certification, I think organic certification is reprehensible because it's so exclusionary, and the people that are running that are not trying to save the planet because they make the bar so high that most people don't want to play. And a lot of spoiled wine because of that. However, get some earthworms going and you'll have minerality. I believe in what Claude Bourguignon says about that, that basically mycorrhizal fungi increase the facilitated uptake, increase the root surface area 100 to 1,000 fold. And if you can get those mycorrhizal fungi going and avoid killing them with a lot of NPK, then you're going to get minerality. And we've proved that. I make a Chardonnay called Faux Chablis off of the Napa Valley College vineyard, which has just about all the weeds there are in the Napa Valley in that very vineyard. And we have a lot of minerality there on a sandy loam. Irrigation and water stress, particularly in the high areas, very important to the way Pinot behaves. Vine age seemed to play an important role. The older vineyards having, and you can argue chicken and egg here, but the older vineyards such as Mount Eden certainly have a dimensionality to them, which we also see in the Constantine Frank Rieslings in New York. So I'm a believer in vine age. And maybe the most important thing to concentrate on, I won't go into a huge amount of detail about this, but I have done in the article, mostly with the help of Laura Ness's notes about clonal differences. But just to say that there certainly is a difference in style between the newer Dijon clones, which tend to be, which tend to be quite fruity, structured, clean, and not quite as exotic and weird as the older clones. And everywhere that we saw, everywhere that we saw the Mount Eden clone, we saw these truffly characteristics. Where we saw the Martini clone, we could detect sandalwood influences, and I certainly think that clones have flavors. Winemaking was not a particularly important variable in this region. Choices about hang time, though, are important, and you need to realize that when you're trying to make a power wine, or when you're forced to make a power wine through extended maturity, that may cut into your ageability. Cold soak is a choice that's made here quite frequently. Yeast choices, percent whole berry, extended maceration, we see all of these. And of course, as you mentioned, the importance of oak selection and duration, which I think almost universally here is used the way it should be. Oak is like fine cosmetics. You're not supposed to know she's wearing any. Okay, so here's the commonalities that we saw throughout the region. One is that the wines are very intense in comparison to, say, Carneros or Russian River. Some critics have even faulted the region because the wines are so intense, but they're intense. They generally have striking sense of place. So when I talk about some of the areas being stronger in this character, perhaps to a fault, this is in the context of an area where everything has a strong sense of place. Rich, multifaceted fruit aromas that vary quite a bit throughout the region. Generally, some exotic elements, we use the words beau rosin and tamarind quite a bit, and also in the Chardonnays, and all kinds of exotic spices. And I talked about the local herb scents to your small planting, so that you have a larger peripheral ratio of the peripheral edge to the volume of the vineyard. and a lot of minerality, which is, in my parlance, I'm talking about the sort of almost electrical buzz in the finish of the wine. I'm not talking about an aroma. And this is, as I said, this isn't a natural element, this is a cultural element, but there's quite a bit of winemaking restraint here. Okay, so now I'm going to go through the regions, but before I do, I want to make it clear that every single site in this area is different. And so don't feel like you're getting shoehorned into having to taste like everybody else in a particular region, because the variability in soil type and aspect and exposure and the differences in clones and all of these elements are much more important in this region than they are in a, you know, like in the valley, for example. Okay, so these are the subregions that we kind of made up. Originally, we were just trying to taste the wines in some kind of reasonable order, and then it turned out that there were striking differences group to group, and so we started trying to describe what they were. And here I want to flip over to the map a little bit to show you where these regions are.